Today on Maine Calling, a UMaine grad on a mission to debunk archaeology falsehoods. There's a lot of misinformation out there, and it's not just about current events. Wild theories about ancient civilizations and alien invasions are all over social media and even television. This really bugs Milo Rossi, an archaeologist and science educator, so much so that he went on to TikTok to debunk falsehoods and share wonderful true stories of humans' past. His TikTok channel grew and grew. Then Rossi started a YouTube channel and wrote a book, and his followers grew to more than 2 million. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we meet Milo Rossi and learn how the whole thing started freshman year at UMaine with an intro archaeology class. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling On Demand is made possible by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn more at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, supporting Maine island communities through education, health, and community engagement. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. These days, fake information online is a part of life, so it is helpful to have people who can debunk falsehoods and pseudoscience. Our guest today is one of those people, super popular, Milo Rossi, a graduate of the University of Maine. He has garnered a large following for his social media presence and his book, The Encyclopedia of the Weird and Wonderful. He presents fact versus fiction on topics ranging from archaeology to environmental science. Milo, thanks for joining us today.
Good morning, Jennifer. Thank you very much for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
What are your questions for Milo Rossi about archaeology, about social media, about his journey to this place? We invite you to join us. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. A reminder, our Maine Calling phone number is different than the number to call for Maine Public's membership drive. The Maine Calling phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Well, Milo, I spent some time this morning looking at your YouTube channel and your TikTok. You've got 2 million followers on TikTok. That is a lot of people.
It is. It's a little bit overwhelming. I feel like even though I've been doing this for a long time, that number has not fully set in yet. I have 2 million on TikTok and 2.2 million on YouTube, which is my larger of the two platforms right now. I'm very blessed with the audience that I have, and it's been really inspiring to really see just how many people have been able to rally around not only archaeology, but around fact. It's very inspiring to see how broad of an audience that seems to have reached and how many people are inspired by it.
I love the perspective here. You say, even though I've been doing this for a long time. What is a long time? 5 years?
Well, yeah. When I started, I was actually still a student at the University of Maine, which was, I guess, in the grand scheme of things, not that long ago. I started about 3 years ago. This was summer of 2021.
Ago.
Yep. The second summer of COVID was when I began my social media journey. I started while I was working doing environmental site remediation, which is what I anticipated doing after graduating college. And I began making videos on TikTok talking about archaeology. As I did that, I began to build a bit of an audience where there was people who were really interested in it. I built a very dedicated and engaged following. And as I began to make more of those videos, I started to see just how much misinformation there was online, especially in the field of archaeology. And being the kind of, you know, punchy, snarky person that I am, I was like, well, this is just the perfect opportunity for me to dismantle some of these things and have a little bit of fun while doing it. And it spread like wildfire, and people really loved it. And so I was able to kind of build that from there to what you see before you today.
Oh my goodness, 3 years, a long time, right?
You know, so, when you put it like that, I suppose not.
Well, so I understand that really this, you know, a lot of people discover their passion or really just grow their passion in college. And I understand for you, it was freshman year, a freshman year class that really sort of supercharged your interest in archaeology.
Absolutely. That's completely correct. So I consider archaeology to be probably my oldest interest. I first sort of discovered the field of archaeology when I was maybe 5 or 6 years old. And it was the discovery of Ötzi the Iceman that really prompted that interest. I was interested in it for pretty much my entire life, even up until, you know, I went to high school. And, you know, through high school, I studied environmental science. I went to a vocational high school where we had to pick a major. So for those 4 years, I studied environmental science. And by the time I was ready to graduate, I was actually thinking about going to university specifically for archaeology. And I had an advisor who was like, you already have, you know, 4,000 experience in hours of experience in environmental science. You should probably stick with that. And I was like, oh, okay, fair enough. So I ended up pursuing that. And it wasn't until my freshman year of college when I had a class at the University of Maine with Dr. Dan Sandweiss, ANT 101, that passion for archaeology was really sort of rekindled. And I ended up adding it to my degree at the University of Maine. So I'm immensely grateful for that class for sort of reigniting that lifelong passion that I never dreamed that I would end up pursuing as an adult.
My goodness. So let me ask you about one. I know this is a big aspect of what you do, but not the only thing, which is debunking myths. And when did this start? Did you see a TV show? Did you see something on social media that just got under your skin? So you decided, okay, I'm doing something about this.
Yeah, well, you know, it's one of those things that it's a little bit of a nebulous start. I don't really think that I can attribute one specific instance to being the thing that got me into it. But even long before I started on social media, I was kind of interested in, falsehoods and in, misinformation and pseudoscience and things like that, because it's something that's everywhere. And I'd always been really interested in the sciences. So being someone with a little bit of a background in it, I was able to kind of see it a lot. It wasn't until I started on social media that I realized I could actually, do something more than just sort of, be able to metabolize it in my own head and be like, well, that's not right. I could actually, go out and communicate to the general public why these things are incorrect using my base of knowledge. And so that was a really lovely thing to be able to do and to be able to find, that collaborative passion between, dismantling science and also being able to teach science. You know, as important as, I think the debunking content is, and as much as it's important to set the record straight, I think it's equally important to also make content that focuses primarily just on the truths. I think that it can be very reactionary and very polarizing to even talk about pseudoscience and pseudoarchaeology and some of the names associated with it. And oftentimes when you begin to delve too deep into those things, the people who need to hear it the most will stop listening. So I find one of the most important approaches is to make content about archaeology, about science, about history that doesn't even really engage with those points, because by putting the correct information out there, it will prevent the general public from falling for that misinformation when they stumble across it in the future.
And isn't one of your points that we don't need to make up things about archaeology and about the past? It's already pretty wild and yeah, crazy and wonderful.
You are absolutely right, Jennifer. Yeah, I think that's another thing that, is a little bit frustrating about the pseudo-archaeology world, is that many of the people who peddle these theories are relying on them to try and make archaeology seem like something that's interesting, when factual archaeology is equally, if not even more, interesting. But it does illustrate an important point that I think academic archaeology and people within the field have had a more difficult time recently engaging with the general public. And it's honestly a lot of the pseudo-archaeology topics that do the best outreach and, reach the broadest audience. And so, that's no fault of the general public. People with no experience in archaeology are not supposed to have to, research it. It should be the jobs of actual archaeologists and actual scientists to be able to make sure that the proper information is out there to prevent the general public from falling for misinformation. So I think that it should stand as a rallying cry for most people within the sciences that what we really need to do is focus on our science communication to ensure that people don't fall for misinformation on their own.
Well, your book is called The Encyclopedia of the Weird and Wonderful. How did you pick what goes in?
You know, that's a good question. So that book went through quite a few different stages, but one of the things that I think is my favorite and most inspiring parts of talking about archaeology and ancient history is really trying to humanize ancient people and ancient archaeological sites. I think it's really easy for us to think that we are so disconnected from ancient people and that we are something that's so much more advanced, or that, you know, ancient people were just more like, you know, in touch with the world, or in, you know, we kind of either will pedestalize them or will, you know, crush them under our boot heels, where in reality, they were people exactly like you and I for the last, you know, 80,000 years. And so in the Encyclopedia of the Weird and Wonderful, I really wanted to try and highlight that, you know, red thread of humanity that has run through every person that's ever lived. So the book follows through a human lifespan. It begins with birth and early education. It talks about meals. It talks about family life. It talks about jobs. And it ends with death and burials, with many other chapters in between. And with each one of those chapters, I talk about something within that topic from a different part of the world in a completely different time period, to give an illustration that no matter where we're from, no matter what time we're from, all of us are pretty much the same.
All right. So what are some of your favorite stories, your favorite videos that you've done, or something you've put in the book that, boy, this is the starter at the dinner party?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, one of my favorite things to talk about is I'm really interested in paleoecology. I think that it's something that's very important to understand when talking about archaeology. An easy example of that is, you know, when we think of the Fertile Crescent, we think of, you know, Mesopotamia and Babylon and, you know, the cradle of civilization. And we look at images of it today and it's a desert. It's a place that, you know, when you think Fertile Crescent, you think, you know, greenery, you don't think of desert. But at the time, 7,000-8,000 years ago, these places had a much damper climate. And so these places were a Fertile Crescent at that time. And by trying to do archaeology there and view these ancient places with the backdrop that they have today, we're doing ourselves a disservice because we're not actually transporting ourselves back in time to what that environment looked like. So something that I try and do with a lot of my work is tie together archaeology and my experience in environmental science and paleoecology to try and paint a picture of what the world would have looked like when many of these archaeological sites were active. Most of my interest in archaeology is sort of in more ancient history. I'm not really one who's super interested in, you know, Rome and Greece and the medieval period and things like that. I'm really interested in things, pretty much anything, you know, pre the dawn of, you know, civilization, air quote. I'm really interested in, you know, our history around 10,000 years ago during the end of the last glacial period. And I think it's really important when talking about those sites to try and convey to the public just how different the world was then. I'm really interested in glacial history as well. In Maine, we have a rich glacial history. And I think that it's really interesting to be able to try and transport ourselves to those times because it allows us to put ourselves in the shoes of people that once lived back then, to be able to humanize them further instead of viewing them as living in the same world that we do today.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Maine, I saw something you did on Mount Kineo.
Yes. Yes. Mount Kineo is a very interesting site. The piece that you saw was talking about Kineo rhyolite, which is the type of stone that Mount Kineo is made out of. Kineo rhyolite makes really amazing stone tools. And the indigenous people of Maine were very aware of that, so much so that Kineo rhyolite has been found as far south as Georgia. It was such an amazing material to work with that it made its way with trade routes down most of the east coast of what's now the United States. And so it's also really interesting to look at those sites because I think that living in a post-colonial country, we can have a really hard time sort of metabolizing, and you know, we aren't really taught just how complex and how sophisticated you know, the indigenous cultures of North America were, and I think that it's really important to talk about those groups as well, because in order to, you know, understand our country better, in order to have reverence for the people that are still very much present here, we need to be able to speak about them with the true level of sophistication that they had you know, before colonization. And I think that Mount Kineo is one of the more interesting examples of that. I wouldn't have known about it unless it was a little anecdote that was sort of shared with me in a classroom. It was something I had not heard in a textbook. It's not like a fun fact I'd heard all that much. And it was something that stuck with me. And I'm like, people need to know about this. Like, this is a really fascinating little tidbit. And so I think it's really, you know, great to use short form media, especially to just be able to convey those little fun facts, little, like, you know, dinner table facts that you can share with your friends and family, because each one of them is something which will not only inspire further passion and research in archaeology, but also give us a much greater appreciation and reverence for the people that came before us.
All right. Well, Milo, before we go to our first break, tell us how people can find you on TikTok or YouTube.
Absolutely. Well, my name is Milo Rossi, but you can find me online at Mini Minuteman, MiniMinuteman, all one word, all lowercase. You can find me on YouTube, TikTok, Instagram. I would recommend YouTube of all places to start. I make my proudest work there, long form videos discussing all sorts of topics in archaeology and ancient history. So you can find me there. Thank you.
Well, we're talking to TikTok and YouTube star Milo Rossi, a recent UMaine grad who tells us, informs us, educates us in a very creative way all about archaeology. Our phone number, if you have a question for him, 1-800-399-3566. You can find us at talk. You can send us an email, talk@mainpublic.org, or you can find us on social media, Instagram or Facebook. We'll be right back with more from Milo Rossi. I'll ask him what kind of overall themes he sees in archaeological falsehoods. We'll be right back.
Maine Calling is made possible by listeners who donate and by Maine Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program, inviting you to be an advocate and voice for long-term care residents across Maine, maineombudsman.org, and The Grasshopper Shop, with downtown locations in Belfast and Rockland, open daily year-round, grasshoppershop.com.
Debunking myths in science it seems like a subject we shouldn't have to be talking about, but we are. And it's really interesting, this conversation with Milo Rossi and Jennifer Rooks. Hi, I'm Keith Shortall, senior editor here at Maine Public, and I'm here with my colleague, Luke Merkel, and we're taking just a few minutes out of the program, as we do at this time, to ask for your support for a program. Since you're listening to us now, I'm guessing you're an advocate and you're a listener to this program, and it's part of your daily life. The number to call to show that support is 1-800-866-1475. Now, note, that's different than the phone number that you've been using to talk to Milo Rossi and to Jennifer. Again, the number, 1-800-866-1475, or Luke, you can go online to mainpublic.org, and it's just an easy process to say, I'm in.
Yeah, Keith. I mean, when you support Maine Public Radio, you're supporting programs like Maine Calling, which bring you such a variety of topics, in-depth conversations. You know, just looking at the schedule we have this week with Maine Calling. Yesterday, the topic was porcupines. Today, we have archaeology, this fascinating conversation you're listening to right now. Then we have native plants and northern lights on Friday. I mean, it is just, this week especially is just like, you know, a celebration of Maine's natural world. And you get that across, you know, Maine Public Radio's programming, whether it's Nature and Nova on Maine Public Television. All right. Whether it's Borealis, the New England Emmy Award-winning program on Maine Public Television. You support that when you make that call on this first day of our fall fundraising drive. And the number to call again is 1-800-866-1475. And Keith, you can also go to mainpublic.org.
Absolutely. It's easy, you know, and also another show this week. So Monday, which was a holiday for many, it was Veterans Day, but we were live doing Maine Calling, and we told that we brought in veterans and learned about their stories. It's always an incredibly popular show, sometimes sad, but sometimes, you know, a great reminder and a great forum for connecting and hearing the stories of veterans all over Maine. That's what Maine Calling does at its best, and we try to keep it at its best as we can. 1-800-866-1475, or go online to mainpublic.org.
You know, Maine Calling has been telling Maine's story for over 60 years, and when you make that call today, you're pledging your support because, you know, Maine Calling is only here because listeners like you have called into pledge drives like this. It's how our system works. We're community-funded, and we're here for you. So please, take a moment, write down the number, or make the call now, 1-800-866-1475. We're going to get right back to this wonderful conversation about archaeology, but Keith and I are here to remind you that this is the first day of Maine Public Radio's fall fundraising drive, and we're here to raise the money to support the wonderful programs that you count on day in and day out from Maine Public Radio. So please, take a moment and call 1-800-866-1475. You can go to mainpublic.org/donate and make your secure gift that way. Thank you so much for your support.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We're learning about how one UMaine graduate has become kind of the Pied Piper for enthusiasm for archaeology. With me, Milo Rossi, an environmental scientist, archaeologist, and author who has popularized the understanding of archaeology and prehistory through social media and other channels. Share your comments and questions. Send us a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org. Comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. And remember, the phone number to talk to Milo is different than our pledge phone number. Again, our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. So, Milo, I'm guessing that some of these myths that you debunk, they probably fall into categories. Even not being a scientist, I'm guessing that you've got a lot of things that have to do with aliens, and you have a lot of things that have to do with missing civilizations.
Yes, yes, both of those quite a bit. And, you know, you also point out something that I think is important to note, Jennifer, for both yourself and for, you know, all of our listeners tuning in today, is that, you know, many of these things, you don't actually have to have any background in science or consider yourself a scientist to be able to sort of see through them and think critically about them. You know, and I think that there is an abundance of information, and most people will not, you know, think of themselves as someone who are capable of breaking these things down. But I find that when I do delve into these things, I'll find a lot of people with little background in these, you know, subjects who are just as capable of being like, oh, you know, that doesn't seem very right to me.
Is there a big one? Is there something out there that kind of maybe not everyone believes, but a lot of people believe that you sort of just want to bang your head against the wall and say, no, no, no. How many times do I have to tell you there is no fill in the blank? Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that, you know, the big one that everyone always thinks of is, you know, ancient aliens. Aliens theories have been around literally forever. But I find that there's really not that many people that actually subscribe to that due to it being something that is more or less an unfalsifiable hypothesis. And in being that, it's something that's also a little bit challenging to, you know, debunk. I can take any piece of information they give me and be like, well, that's because of this. It's not because of aliens. But at the end of the day, if someone wants to say, you know, aliens came to the Earth, it's like, well, what am I supposed to do? Like, look around and you know, absence of evidence is not, you know, evidence of absence. And so I think that the one that seems to be the most common and the one that I believe has gained the most traction recently is sort of splinter theories branching off of Atlantis and the idea of a lost advanced master civilization. So these theories are things that have been perpetuated for many, many years. They have gone through many different iterations. They originated in, you know, books and storytelling. Today, they've made their way all the way into television shows and podcasts. And most of them, while they kind of, you know, vary in what their topic is, they claim that there was at some point one large civilization that was destroyed in a cataclysm that went on to found, whose survivors went on to go found many of the large and most famous civilizations from ancient history around the world. Now, this theory is something which has gained a lot of popularity recently and is something that I believe is presented in such a way that even those with no experience in science, with no experience in archaeology, are especially susceptible to believing in it, because it's something that is presented by those who really claim to kind of know what they're talking about. And it's presented in a way that can be a little bit predatory and manipulative of facts in order to try and support these theories. While the issue with it is that, you know, many of these theories, even though they are, you know, not true, the deeper issue is that many of them really only give explanations for, you know, non-European civilizations, which begins to get into a little bit of an iffy territory, especially when discussing the history of, you know, Atlantis theory. You know, things like, you know, ancient Central American civilizations, ancient, you know, North American civilizations, Polynesian peoples, you know, different groups around the world that were allegedly descendants of this lost advanced civilization. Now, while many people who talk about this theory and are interested in this theory are, in my opinion, not trying to do it in a way that's condescending towards different groups of indigenous people, it's hard to hide that it comes across like that, where there's no question given to, you know, how the people of ancient Rome were able to construct the Colosseum, but the earthworks in the Mississippi River Valley are something which are, you know, up for debate and something which are, you know, highly skeptical as to what their origin is.
Oh, interesting. I never thought of it that way, but that depending where something is happening in the world and who the people are who might have built it, we're seeing this unconscious or not unconscious bias.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's something that's it's a difficult one to talk about, because I believe it needs to be approached with, you know, an appropriate level of sensitivity, because there's two approaches to it. One, you know, it's important to discuss, because I think that looking at those implicit biases is something that's very important, not only for pseudoscience, but also for science. A mirror that I try and hold up and talk about in my work all the time is that, you know, many origins of scientific processes have roots in racist ideology and racist theory. And that's something that we need to work, you know, tirelessly to dismantle in the modern world, and something that we need to figure out how the relics of it may still exist in modern scientific theory. And it's also important to talk about it because it is something that's very prevalent in, you know, pseudo-archaeological and pseudo-scientific theories. And even though these theories are, in my opinion, not things where they are, you know, doing this consciously, I believe that most of the people who peddle these theories, I believe that most of the people who are interested and believe in these theories are not doing it because of that. And that's a very important thing that you have to acknowledge, because you have to be able to talk about these things and also not make it feel like you are, you know, pointing the finger at people and accusing them of, you know, doing this consciously, because that's the kind of point where people will shut down and no longer listen, when I believe it's really important for them to actually have the kind of gravity of these issues conveyed to them in a way so that they can really be able to reflect how their theories may be harmful.
I'm going to go to Ellery, who's calling from Waterville. Hi, Ellery.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call. In just these last few minutes, there have been so many more questions raised in my mind. But the reason I called, when we develop defined artifacts, uncover this, that, discuss ancient cultures from what little information we can find, often ideas are put forward, a theory, a myth perhaps develops, and then it changes because we learn more. When you mention myth, now, is that mostly a reference to where we are in our current thinking, as in that thinking will change, the truth perhaps will change as we learn more? And I'm not sure everyone understands that that it's a process to go from a myth to fact, if that is indeed the case. And what mysteries are there out there that have been changing because of what we've been learning?
That's a really amazing question, and I think you actually bring up something really important there, that science is something which is constantly changing. Our understanding of the ancient world is something which will continue to be refined pretty much, you know, ad infinitum. I think that that is a piece that many pseudo-archaeologists will sort of cling to in order to back up their theories, is this idea that, like, anytime something is found that challenges the scientific paradigm, it's proof that all of science has been wrong, and that this one person who's saying this one theory, they have the capital T truth. But in reality, that's just not the case. Science works by constantly uncovering new evidence and by constantly refining what it already knows. And I think that there is this misunderstanding that science claims to have all of the facts, when in reality, that's just simply not how science operates. Many, you know, kind of within the pseudoscience field will cling to discoveries of things like Göbekli Tepe, a site which pushed back the date of megalithic architecture by thousands of years, or, you know, the discovery of pre-Clovis tools in North America as evidence that archaeologists are wrong and, you know, will never actually understand the truth, when in reality, all of those discoveries are things that have actually changed the understanding of scientists because there's tangible evidence for it. And so I think that it's important to keep that in mind, that when presented with new evidence, science will change its mind.
Ellery, thanks so much for calling in and being part of the program today. We have an email here from John, and John asked two really good questions, Milo, so I'm going to take them one at a time. He writes,
absolutely.
I'm a retired history teacher. I always started teaching world history in prehistoric times. This was unique and not supported by colleagues who began in Mesopotamia, Greece, and Rome. Kids always loved the early years and identified with them. Why do we so often ignore this part of our story? Why do you think?
That's really interesting. I think there could be many answers to that question, but a couple that I'm thinking of, one and probably the largest, is that it is a very long time ago. The difficulty with learning about things pre-civilization is that pre-civilization, we have no writings left over from it. Even in early civilizations, we have minimal writings left. But at a time before the dawn of, you know, the written word, we just don't have as much information. Archaeology is assembling a puzzle where you've lost the box and most of the pieces. So we do the best with the pieces that we have at our disposal. And the farther back you go, the older the puzzle is, the less pieces there are left and the harder it is to interpret. So I think the first reason would be that there is just simply less information the farther back you go. I also think, and this one might be a little bit more of a, you know, sort of, you know, philosophical or political take. But I think that it's also a group that we have a harder time sort of identifying with in the way that our modern society is structured. For a majority of human history, we existed in bands of between 50 and 200 individuals, where we lived, you know, non-sedentary lives or only partly sedentary lives. We hunted and gathered, we followed herd migrations, and, you know, we lived in small, tight-knit communities. After the dawn of civilization and the rise of agriculture, we no longer lived in those societies anymore, or we began to transition away from them, where we lived in large, you know, cities, and we, you know, began to produce our own food. And as that transition began to happen, you know, we laid the foundation for the societies that we have today, where all of us live in homes, we live in cities, and we have, you know, sedentary networks. And so I believe that there's, you know, whether a conscious or unconscious decision to not talk about those things, because that's just not the way that society works anymore, even though it is something that has dictated the way that humanity has existed for almost all of the time it has existed.
The second part of John's question, do you think that AI is going to further blur or make it difficult to find real facts about early history and real facts in the emails all capitalized?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's an appropriate place for an all capital real fact. It certainly is. I've already encountered instances of people supporting pseudo-archaeological claims using AI generated images. I think that with, you know, AI slowly kind of turning into the Ouroboros, you know, the snake eating its own tail, AI generated, you know, information based off of other AI generated information will slowly turn into a game of broken telephone where it's harder and harder to discern what real facts are. And I believe that's a threat not only to pseudo-archaeology, but to, you know, the world of fact as a whole. You know, but on the flip side of that, I think there are applications that we are seeing of AI in the field that have actually, you know, been able to do quite a bit of good. There was recently an article published talking about the Nazca lines, which are huge sort of earth glyphs in Chile, I believe. And they are pretty famous. You may be familiar with them. They're, you know, images of birds and, you know, like all of these different, like a monkey and things like that, which are like made on hillsides out of stones. One of the classic pseudo-archaeology takes is that, you know, they must have had spacecraft in order to be able to see them because they're only visible from, you know, the air. But there are actually many more of these geoglyphs, and a lot of them are a lot smaller, only down to a few meters. And scientists recently were actually able to train AI by giving satellite imagery of some of these smaller geoglyphs that have been deteriorated over time, and then just running a bunch of satellite images through that AI, and it was able to identify, like, I think it was, I'm not going to name an exact figure, but it was many, many more of these glyphs that had just never been noticed by the human eye. So I think that while it's very important to find ways to act responsibly about AI and to make sure that it doesn't end up in sort of a misinformation, you know, tailspin, I think that there are applications within the field that could be very beneficial in the future.
Well, give us some advice then, Milo, because given the fact that some real facts, real archaeology is amazing and hard to believe. Some, you know, we can visit some of the places that are amazing and hard to get your head around how somebody without modern tools would have built something or communicated something. Given that real archaeology can be amazing, how do we as lay people start to discern fact from fiction? And what are the some of the codes that suddenly automatically give you a red flag, like, oh boy, here we go again?
Well, you know, one of the terms that I think we hear a lot, all of us, no matter what field we're in, that we hear a lot from people who are, you know, sort of in the more conspiratorial mindset is the idea of, I do my own research, which is a shame because doing your own research is exactly what you should do. But frequently when people talk about that, they mean that they listened to one podcast episode and, you know, like looked at a bunch of Facebook memes. But really, I do think the single greatest piece of advice that I could give to people who want to discern truth from fiction is to actually do their own research. Go online, look into scientific papers, look into, you know, you don't even have to look into papers. You can look into articles, look at National Geographic, look at the Smithsonian, look at the BBC, find reliable sources and cross-reference them amongst one another. There's kind of this idea by the do your own research crowd that, you know, any of the big names, you know, whether it's Reuters or whether it's, you know, the Associated Press or anything from Google is all controlled by the evil cabal, which is a perfect way of just weeding out all of the actual information so you can have an excuse to just listen to the Facebook memes. But I would encourage anyone who, you know, is interested in these facts to simply scratch the surface. If you hear something that seems incorrect, literally just Google it. If something can be debunked by the first three results on Google, chances are it's probably not true.
All right. Well, we are talking with archaeologist, environmental scientist, author, and Social media star Milo Rossi. What are your questions for him? 1-800-399-3566. The email address, talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back.
Maine Calling is made possible by listeners who donate and by Hannaford Supermarkets, celebrating the diversity of its employees, customers, and communities, and committed to fostering a welcoming environment. And the Chocolate Church Art Center, who believe new futures unfold where art and community become one. ChocolateChurchArts.org.
The second day of Maine Public's fall fundraising drive is underway. Excuse me, the first day. Wow, getting ahead of myself. My name is Luke Merkel. I'm part of the corporate support team here at Maine Public, and I'm joined with Keith Shortle, senior news editor. Hi, Keith. It's great to be with you. This conversation about misinformation in AI, you know, relevant to the science community, the archaeology community.
Yeah.
Obviously, very relevant to the work that you do on the news team as well.
Yeah, I mean, as I said earlier, it's like it's weird needing to have a conversation or having someone devote their life to debunking myths in science, which is really another word for fact. So, yeah. You know, but here we are. And it's also really just fascinating to see that rather than simply just lay out, oh, you know, this is wrong or that's wrong, it's sort of like a brand new way of communicating in some of these TikTok videos, which is, you know, it's a lot of entertainment. You get a little extra for your buck, and that's sort of like what we're doing here today. Did you see what I did there? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So programs like Maine Calling are, you know, technically free. I'm using air quotes, but of course they're not, and they depend on you, the listener, to allow us to buy the programming from NPR to hire the people like Jen Rooks and to bring these programs to you. The number, 1-800-866-1475, a reminder that's different than the phone number that you would use to reach Maine Calling. But again, the number to pledge your support for programs like this is 1-800-866-1475, or you can do it online at mainepublic.org.
Yeah, Keith, that 75% of the funding that Maine Public receives is what we use to make sure that we have the team that helps fact check and do the research and do the work to help make sure that this is a source of trusted information, not only for you, but for your community. And when you make that gift, you're bringing this information and enjoying it not only for yourself, but for your neighbor, for your community, and for the state of Maine, and even beyond Maine. Maine Public Radio just has such a big, a coverage area, and we're able to do that because, you know, we're able to have trusted information from trusted staff and journalists, and also have signals, FM signals, in a part of a big rural state to be able to reach as many people as we can free and over the air. That work is made possible by you. So please make that call now and support that. 1-800-866-1475. You can also make your gift at mainepublic.org/donate.
As you say, Luke, it's a trusted source. Names that you know. If you want an update on the news or weather, there's Erwin Gratz in the morning and Lou McNally. If you want a conversation like you're hearing today, Jen Rooks and Cindy Hahn, familiar voices. I sit in there once in a while. Maine Public Radio is there for you, and it's made possible because of the generosity of people like you who have been doing this model, by the way, for 60 years, and so it's tried and true. But we need your support now, you know, more than ever, I would say, and now is your chance to be part of this trusted partnership by investing in Maine Public Radio. 1-800-866-1475, or go online to mainepublic.org, and thank you.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. We're having a terrific conversation today with Milo Rossi. He's a recent University of Maine graduate and already a social media star. His topic, archaeology. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. I'm going to repeat that since it's different than the pledge number, 1-800-399-3566. If you're really fast, you can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. We'll go to William, who's calling from Norway, as in Norway, Maine. Hi, William, go ahead.
Milo, I have two questions. The first one is about Have you done any or have any information on the red paint people?
Yes, I think that's a really interesting topic.
Yeah, why don't we have Milo answer that, and then we'll have your second question. Go ahead, Milo.
Yeah, William, thank you very much for calling in and for asking. The red paint people, I think, are a really interesting group and a group that I'm actually looking to make a video on at some point soon. They are a people that I really only became familiar with going to the University of Maine. For those of you listening in who aren't familiar, they are one of the first sort of ancestral indigenous groups along the Maine coast. So some of the earliest archaeological sites in the state, as you know, glaciation receded and as you know, life began to return to the coastline, were the red paint people, and they're named that, I believe, for their use of red ochre in I can't remember if it was burials or artistic works, but in some of their ceremonies. And I believe they're a group that, in the grand scheme of you know paleo indigenous peoples, are rather underrepresented and under talked about in sort of the public space. To answer your question, I think they are a fascinating group and are a group that I would really like to dive into a little bit more, especially utilizing some of my connections at the university who have a deep understanding of the topic, so that it's something that I can bring to the general public to greater the general public understanding of what I believe to be an incredibly important group of people.
All right, William, what's your second question for Milo?
Okay, the second question actually is, it has to do with coastal settlements. But Milo's probably familiar, but not everybody. As the glaciers retreated, the land had been depressed, and the water came in, and there were former coastlines well inland in Maine, and whether much archaeological research has been done along these former coastlines for our settlements or, you know, even shell middens or anything like that inland.
Yeah, that's another really interesting feature, I think, of Maine's coastal archaeology and geology. So the phenomenon that William's talking about here is known as isostatic rebound. As the glaciers receded off of the North American continent, the land itself had been compressed lower. And so this resulted in the ocean actually coming inland by quite a bit. So places like Bangor and all the way up to Orono, where I went to the university, were actually under below sea level. However, as that glacial weight receded, the earth began to rebound, that isostatic rebound, and brought the land level back up. And because still huge amounts of water were locked up in these massive glaciers farther north, the sea level ended up being much lower than it is today. So while I'm not entirely sure about many archaeological sites that show evidence of settlements around water that was a result of isostatic rebound, there are archaeological sites that are below the current sea level that were formed when the sea level was much lower, about, you know, I believe like 5,000 years ago. Just one of these is known as Blue Hill Bay, which is a paleo-indigenous hunting site off the coast of Maine. It used to be a peninsula, it became an island, and is now completely underwater. And at this site, there is evidence of, I believe, caribou hunting. And it's another site that I've actually thought about doing a video on. I have a professor, Dr. Alice Kelly from the University of Maine, who her and her husband actually did quite a bit of work at that site. And I've been thinking about trying to go and return to it with her so that she can share some of her knowledge on it. Because I think it's a really interesting topic to talk about that, you know, people have always clung to the coastlines, and so much of our ancient history has kind of been lost as that sea level has risen.
William, thank you for your great questions. We'll move on. We'll go to
thank
Sean.
You, William.
Yeah, Sean's calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Hi, Sean.
Hey, I actually have basically two questions about sources for you, Milo. Why do you think
absolutely lay it on me?
Why do you think people turn from these mainstream academia sources like Natural Geographic and all that into listening to people like Joe Rogan and all that? Why do you think there is that transfer there? If, you know, because I remember your Philip Ziba video, you talked about how you think they all have sort of a genuine interest in it.
Yeah, that's a really good question. That's something I've pondered quite a bit to try and figure out what the psychology is there. And I believe it sort of varies from case to case. But I think one of the largest sort of reasons for it is because many of those sources, like you know, a Joe Rogan or like, you know, one of those sort of alternative history groups, not only will they provide sort of, you know, alternative facts, as it were, but they will also kind of go out of their way to, you know, diminish or to lay the seeds of doubt and mistrust in more reliable sources. There is something that is, you know, it's a little bit harder to have to take a nuanced look at the multiple different outcomes of science and the multiple different sources of information we have than it is to just sort of listen to the one guy who says, I am the truth and everything that I say is right and everyone else is trying to lie to you. With that, I think there is kind of this general, you know, underlying thread of anti-establishment sentiment that runs in a lot of these communities. And this isn't the anti-establishment of like, you know, hey, if only we, you know, minimum wage was a little higher. It's the anti-establishment that like all the news sources are controlled by one group and they're all trying to lie to us. And so when you kind of begin to fall into that, you know, pipeline and circle that drain, you will just listen to less and less things. And the only people you will listen to are those that tell you everyone else is lying. And frequently that ends up becoming an echo chamber. So it's a good question and one that I try and wrap my head around it as well as you do.
Sean, thank you so much for calling. Here we have an email from Badiran. Please tell Milo I love him so much for his work and contribution to the world of archaeology. I'm an archaeology student from Bill Kent University from Ankara, Turkey. I have worked in the places he visited in his Turkey episodes. My question is, what is Milo's favorite conspiracy out of all? Like the one that seems actually like a cool idea for him. I'm sure there is no favorite conspiracy for him to debunk, so he's so tired of talking about that. So which one would you like to be have be true?
Oh, man. You know, there's a lot of them. I think that if I were to pick a single one, the one that I think the most endearing is the idea that the Great Pyramid of Giza was a giant power plant. There is an entire book written on it, which I've been meaning to get into, where someone wrote like a whole, you know, scientific, I am doing air quotes for those of you that can't see, book talking about how, you know, the quartz made that they used to make the pyramid can conduct enough electricity that with the, you know, compression speed of the earth, it could generate, you know, power in the cavity. And like, do I believe that? Absolutely not. But every time I hear it, I'm like, man, that's hilarious. I wish that were true.
We'll go to Susan, who's calling from Kingfield. Hi, Susan. Go ahead. Susan, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. I just wanted to make sure I go off speaker. I have a pyramid question as well. I had recently heard that there was some form of hydrology that was used to lift the stones to the peak of the – lift the stones in building the pyramids.
That's an interesting point. So that is one of the running theories about how the base of the pyramid was constructed and how stones were transported to the dig or to the build site. So this would have been done. The pyramids are in the Nile River floodplain, and the you know, Egyptians who had knowledge of, you know, using boats to transport large heavy stones may have cut channels that would have flooded the base where the pyramid was constructed. And they would have dug a hole where the pyramid was going to be that was below the water line. Water would have flowed in there. This would have also allowed them to etch a uniform height around the side of the pit where the pyramid was going to go. Then they would have been able to float large stones in there to act as the foundation. So that's one of the theories for how it was done. They likely would not have actually floated these stones for any higher levels because they wouldn't have been able to build something that water could have, you know, gone all the way to the top of the pyramid. But that is one of the running theories for how they were able to transport some of the largest stones that make up the base of the pyramid.
Well, Susan, thanks so much for your question. I appreciate it. Milo, we are almost out of time. We so appreciate your time with us. Remind us again how to find you on YouTube and how to find you on TikTok.
Absolutely. Well, once again, my name is Milo Rossi. You can find me online at Mini Minuteman. You can find me on YouTube. You can find me on TikTok, and you can find me on Instagram. I appreciate the time here today. Jennifer, thank you very much for having me on. And I'd like to give another really big thank you to all of you for tuning in and listening today. It's really an honor to be here on Maine Public. So thank you all very much for having me.
And that's Milo Rossi, an environmental scientist, archaeologist, author, and science educator, and also a pretty recent UMaine graduate. You can find him on YouTube, again, by searching Mini Minute Man. Today's sound engineer is Sam Tracy. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, how to think and plan ahead to add native plants to your landscape and why. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.
Maine Calling is made possible by listeners who donate and by Friends of Acadia, powered by members who believe in preserving and protecting Acadia National Park for future generations. Join today, friendsofacadia.org, and BCM Environmental and Land Law, focused on Northern New England environmental law and land issues. BCMEnvirolaw.com.
Another hour of interesting stuff. Hi, Keith Shortall, senior editor here at Maine Public, and I'm here with my colleague Luke Merkel on this first day of our fall drive. You've just heard an hour of Maine Calling, really interesting conversation about, you know, protecting the truth, defending fact. This is all, we're just taking this break from the programming also just to remind you that this kind of programming is only possible because of you. This is the way that the system has worked. 70% of our funding comes from you, people who are listening to us right now within the sound of my voice. The number to join this system is 1-800-866-1475. You can go online, Luke, at mainpublic.org. It's very easy. There's a donate button. It's easy, but it's also really important. We can't say it enough, and we'll say it again and again. 1-800-866-1475 or online at mainpublic.org.
Yeah, Keith, we've got a room full of volunteers here in our Portland studio, so thank you for coming out today. They're eagerly awaiting your call, so please, won't you be the next caller and pledge your support to your public radio station? The reason we can be so community-focused is because we are community-funded. So again, there's the call right there. Thank you so much for your call. Join them, 1-800-866-1475. Perhaps you're an Evergreen friend already. I'm an Evergreen friend. I think you are, Keith. You know, our Evergreen Friend program is our intentionally monthly giving program, and you just set an amount, and it comes each and every month out of your account, and you know that every time you listen to Maine Calling or Maine Public Radio, you get that warm feeling inside knowing that you help make it possible. And, you know, this pledge drive, there's actually another way to feel warm by donating.
I was going to say, yeah, if you don't get a warm feeling inside, you can get one externally with this thank you gift from Maine Public for $30 a month. That's or $360 for a year. That's a little less than a dollar a day. We'll literally keep you warm with this beautiful blanket, this throw size blanket. It's a blue and green buffalo plaid print. It's got the Maine Public logo right there, not too big, just right to let other people know who you support and where the blanket came from. It's 55% recycled wool, and it comes from our friends at Minus 33 in Ashland, New Hampshire. Again, that's available for a donation of $30 a month or $360 a year.
Yeah, Keith. I mean, it says it's a throw blanket, but that's not really doing it justice. This blanket is bigger than your average throw blanket. It's heavier than your average throw blanket. You know, Minus 33 does such great work. We've had socks of them before as part of our pledge thank you gifts. And so they just do. So please, it's just a great way to show your pride and get cozy listening to Maine Public Radio for the winter. And I would also like to say this pledge drive, we have a Wine Wednesday offer. And this is if you donate $150 or more, you could attend a virtual wine tasting with Rick Steves. Again, that number to call, 1-800-866-1475. So with that $150 donation, you will be entered to win that wine tasting. You know Rick Steves from his many adventures on Maine Public Television and here on Maine Public Radio too. Now you have the chance to attend a virtual wine tasting with him as a reward for your investment in this service. So again, that gift of $150 or more, you can choose, you can be entered to win this wine tasting, and it's a virtual event. It will take place on February 11th. There are a couple of restrictions I must mention you must be 21 years or older and sign for the wine tasting kit when it's delivered, and sign for the kit when it's delivered. The kit cannot be delivered to a PO box, and it cannot be shipped to Canada and some U.S. states. So check out those restrictions when you go online to mainpublic.org/donate. But again, we're here to raise money for Maine Public Radio and all the programs you count on. The number to do that is 1-800-866-1475.
Yeah, what a cool, wouldn't that be a cool, fun thing to do, is be in a wine tasting virtually with Rick Steves. Rick Steves, I'm a big fan of for all of his work, as you mentioned. And it's just, you know, it's a thank you to those of you who, and by the way, for those of you who have become members or have added to your membership, thank you. We want to say that if you haven't, there's no better time than right now here in this midday, as we're bringing you some of that midday programming that you have come to trust and depend on. Programs like On Point earlier, like Maine Calling, like Here and Now.
Yeah.
These are all part of that, you know, probably part of the day that you plan around and that you organize your life around and come to depend upon as a citizen. The number is 1-800-866-1475 or online at mainpublic.org.
And this is listener-supported Maine Public Radio.